Generating traffic and sales can be a challenge for online merchants. But selling on the Walmart Marketplace puts your products in front of millions of customers who shop on Walmart.com. And right now, sellers who join Walmart Marketplace can save up to 50% on referral and fulfillment fees for the first 90 days. So get started today. Head over to marketplace.walmart.com/savings. That's marketplace.walmart.com/savings. Welcome to E-Commerce Conversations, a weekly podcast from Practical E-Commerce, hosted by entrepreneur Eric Bandholz.
What is going on, Internet? Eric Bandholz back again with another E-Commerce Conversations. Hope all is going well on the other side of the Internet. On the other side of the Internet from me, Chris, what's up, man?
How's it going?
I'm well.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Excited to talk about some Twitter ads.
Yeah. Well, who the hell are you, man?
So I'm a copywriter. I have a copywriting agency called Orzy Media, and probably best known as a copywriter and email marketer. I've worked with a lot of direct consumer brands. The one that everyone tends to know me for is Carnivore Snacks. I've worked with them since they were pre-revenue. But yeah, over the past, this is year 11 for me, have just written for tons of brands in the space. And what I specialize in, what makes me a little bit different, is just, you know, copy heavy plain text emails or story driven emails that are a little bit different than the traditional, I call them like pretty poster style emails. And yeah, that's kind of like my signature move, signature style. And I just started getting into, you know, Twitter ads just out of my own necessity, just having issues with Facebook. But what I like to do is just help people with copy and help them just craft better messaging. And I find this leads to better retention and helps you like differentiate your brand a little bit.
Are you just a freelance guy, or do you have an agency with a team helping you out, or?
Yeah, I was freelance for, you know, most of my career. And then back in 2020, I launched my agency. Actually, the day I came home from the hospital with my firstborn son, I put him down for a nap, launched my agency, because it was March 2020. So everything was like shut down. I was like, all right, my hunch was that e-com was going to boom. And I was right. Because I was like, no, you can't go to these stores, right? So people aren't going to stop buying stuff no matter what, because that always happens. And my hunch was correct. So yeah, I've had a team for, I guess, 4 years now. And so it's a small team. It's not a huge operation, but we like to do, you know, pretty boutique job, go deep with our clients, and just help them craft like really unique voice and messaging with everything that they do.
How do you find the right type of talent that can execute at your level of expectations?
I train them. So I have 8,000 people on my email list, and a good percentage of them are other marketers and copywriters. Not everyone. I mean, there's a lot of people out there, but like I have my students have worked for tons and tons and tons of brands and gurus in this course space and SaaS companies and everything else. So I have a really good, high quality group of people who over the years, I started publishing my newsletter back in 2016 and I've been writing daily ever since then for the last 7 years. So, you know, I've had an opportunity to train a lot of those people. So a lot of times when I recruit for my own organization, I just pull people from my audience. I just pull the stars from my audience and say, okay, these are the people I've seen their work. I've seen what they've done with other brands. I've tested them out. I'm familiar with their stuff. So it's kind of like a nice feeder program for what I'm doing.
Do you find that you have to deal with like a lot of turnover, or do people get bored, like going from like an in-house to an agency or vice versa? You know, do you see that kind of movement with your people?
Not a ton. I know that happens maybe with some bigger agencies. The reason I think that we don't have that problem is we do have a lot of variety of clients coming in the door. So I like to try to find people who, like, sometimes with writers or any type of creatives, like there's sometimes like people who like, I only do alternative health, or I only do this kind of product or that kind of product. But I like for people who have range and who like writing for immersing themselves very fast in a different type of product category. So just because it's the nature of like the type of work that we've always done. So I haven't, you know, knock on wood, I haven't really had that issue, but we just keep it fun and dynamic. And for me, it's like, I'm going to go out and get the clients. I'm going to get the big name people in. I'm going to get the big name brands. And then a lot of times what I found is, you know, the people in my audience, they don't have the same level of access. So they get an opportunity to work with some brands that they would never, you know, most of the time would never have a chance to work with if they were just freelance.
Okay. So One of the things that I just had a conversation with my buddy Will Roman over at Chisos, and he's been trying to figure out how to bring on help to, you know, help them scale, help operations, help marketing. And I said, like, you need to hire a copywriter, you know, like, because I feel like copywriters in e-com are worth their weight in gold. And I want to talk about, like, what are the things that you identify as a good copywriter who can create copy that sells, you know, versus just someone who is good at grammar?
So there's a few main things that I look for. Like I'm looking to bring on a writer right now, actually. So I've been going through a few applications and I'm like, just send me your samples. And it's funny, I've had to like create a process because it's in my brain, right? So I've had to actually like be like, what am I actually looking for? So like when I was looking through this writer's stuff yesterday, I was like, I saw, you know, a landing page, a couple emails, a video script. And so like things I look for, like, are they instinctively lacing story into their ads, right? So like if there's a hint of a story, that's usually like a good sign that they have some good instincts. If they are dimensionalizing, which just means like, you know, you have a feature of the product and then everyone says like features and benefits, right? So then what's the benefit of the feature? The next step after the benefit is the dimensionalization. That's like, how does the product change your life once you use it, right? So if I see people lacing those things into the copy, I'm like, okay, they get it, right? Like they instinctively get it. It's not just about like, you know, this water bottle has this cool nozzle, which helps you drink water faster. It's like, well, why does that matter, right? Like that next step, that's always what I'm looking for. It's like, how do you continue? Because when someone's reading it, you know, they're reading the product description, email, whatever it is, like they don't really care about the widget or the features that much. They care about like, how is this going to benefit me? And how does my life change for the better? What am I going to no longer have to worry about now that I have this feature in my life? So those are things that I tend to look for. And just, is it fun? Is it exciting? Is it different? Is their voice, is their personality in the copy? Because especially in e-commerce, I think I saw that there were at least 4 million Shopify stores, if my number is correct.
I have no idea.
Like just an insane number. Yeah, I Googled this the other day and I was like, wow, I couldn't even believe that. Like if that's accurate, like just millions of stores and there's so many people selling something similar to what you have. So like, how do you stand out? And it's like, the marketing, the copy, the voice, the personality, like all those things are what's going to help you be the brand that wins, you know, mind share in your customer's brain.
I feel like if there's any copywriters listening, I don't know if there are mostly entrepreneurs here, but or entrepreneurs who do copy, I feel like inherently from my experience, at least in public schools and in college, is they teach you how to write properly. They don't teach you how to write with character or with like uniqueness, for lack of better terms. So anyone who is out there who wants to be a writer, as much as possible, write in a true, authentic voice rather than what you think people want to hear. From my own personal take, would you agree with that concept? Or do you think sometimes that can get someone in the wrong, you know, like the wrong pan or whatever?
I agree. And like, it's funny you bring up the college thing. I almost failed out of my freshman writing course. I had to get like a tutor and everything because they want you to write in a very specific way. And now I look back and I'm like, you know, I probably make that professor's salary every month. You know what I mean? So like as a writer, you know, it's just so funny, like how, you know, they do try to pigeonhole you into this certain way of doing things. But at the end of the day, it's like, you have to make things exciting. You have to make things interesting because especially nowadays, people are just scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. They're seeing, you know, there's that stat that gets thrown around, you know, I think 20 years ago, people would get like 5,000 ads a day. It's probably 50,000 now. It's an insane number of just advertisements and pieces of media. So it's like in a split second, how do you stand out? And it just gets harder and harder every single year. So you have to just think outside the box. You have to get a little bit crazy. You have to do things that are arresting and thumb stopping. And when you do that, that's how you get outsized results.
How do you, so you talked about training them. Do you have any recommendations for content for people to leverage or to learn from on how to become a better copywriter?
Yeah. I mean, I have a ton of stuff on my blog. I mean, there's a lot of good teachers out there, you know. One of the other things that I do is I just look at a lot of like old space ads too, like, you know, from like the 70s. There's a lot of like good old like Porsche ads. There's every different type of industry. There's like these really just epic, amazing, you know, oftentimes they were written by big brands, but you can even find like long form Ford Motor Company advertisements from decades past. So like the whole like long form copy thing, it's not really a new thing. It's been around forever. And in fact, it used to be kind of the norm for most industries and most products before we had, you know, video and everything on the internet now. So, if part of it is just being curious, part of it is just immersing yourself within the industries that you're working in, seeing what everyone's doing, and then also looking at other industries and seeing what you could borrow, what type of frameworks, what type of stories, what type of formats, and just be like, you really just have to be like a truffle hound, right? Just keeping your nose to the ground, just looking for good angles that you could, adapt and modify and expand upon and improve upon for the products that you are selling.
So I want to segue this into Twitter ads. That's the big thing I want to talk about in this episode. Meta ads have gone through the roof, or they've been hyper volatile. And I'm a big time Twitter user, for those who don't already know. But I see, Elon reposting all this stuff about how Twitter ads are super cheap, and results are killer. And I'm a little skeptical. Are you seeing people making money on Twitter currently, or X?
Yeah. And I was skeptical too, because for the longest time I had heard from so many people that, like, oh, don't even waste your time. Like, it's, and I think maybe in years past that might have been true. I think probably pre-Elon, back in like the late 20 teens, definitely that was the case. I even tried to use the platform back then. I was like, this thing is wonky, but they've made a lot of improvements. And like, I had this similar frustrations. I was locked out of my Meta account for over a year just because I forgot to transfer the 2FA token from my old phone to my new phone. Then I wiped the old phone, I sent it in. So like I couldn't get back in no matter what I tried. I couldn't talk to some of the Facebook support. So I was like locked out. So finally, like I made a new account and I was getting a new ad account set up, and it was just like I was just having trouble with it. And I was like, let me explore some other avenues. And I was like, what about Twitter? I was like, I'm on Twitter all the time. And I started like looking around, I started noticing ads. And some of these ads were like they'd have 10 million impressions on them. And I'm like, okay, I think they're probably cheaper than other platforms. But I was like, even if they're 50% cheaper, let's just say, right? Or 75% cheaper, how much money do you have to spend to run an ad up to 10 million impressions? Right. And then I saw other ads that had 24 million impressions, other ads that had 6 million impressions, other one ad that had 55 million impressions. So I said, okay. And these are big successful brands in the DTC space, right? And I said, I don't think those people are idiots who are running those ads, right? Like, I think they're probably pretty smart. And I think there's a reason that they're doing this. And I think there's a reason that they're continuing to spend money to the point where an ad can get to millions of impressions or tens of millions of impressions, right? I even saw one ad that had like 112 million impressions. And like, when you think about a Super Bowl ad has 106 million or 107 million impressions, give or take, right? Given the year. So I was like, there's got to be something here. And then I would see these like obscure brands. Like, there was this one brand, one of the first brands. It was, I believe it was called Rachel's Texas Kitchen. And it was this like family of Mennonites, and they would sell like $11.99 jars of peaches and beets and pickled vegetables. And I was like, hold on. They're making it work. Their ads have like millions of impressions, each one of them, right? And they're selling, fruit that you could buy in the grocery store. I mean, it's probably much better than anything you buy in the grocery store, maybe comparable to like a farmer's market or something. But I said, okay, they're spending money. They're running a lot of different ads. I'm seeing these ads all the time. So I was like, there's got to be something here. And then I started noticing like Hexclad was running ads and Ridge Wallet was running ads and some of these other big, DTC brands in the space were running ads there. So I said, okay, you got all these people over here who are saying Twitter ads don't work. But then you have all these companies over here that are clearly running ads all the time, testing out different formats, running them up to super high numbers. So I was like, well, who's right? Right. And I was like, they probably work for some people. So I started experimenting with myself and started launching a few campaigns, and the costs were super cheap. I mean, some of my campaigns had 38 cent CPMs. I was getting clicks for like, a quarter maybe, right? Given a different campaign, maybe a little bit more sometimes. And we have clients right now who are getting clicks anywhere from like 8 cents to 79 cents, right? So again, not that that's necessarily the most important thing, but I started experimenting this with my own for my book, for my lead magnet, for some services, and I was getting leads. And I was like, okay, well, clearly it works. And then you think about it, it's like I go on Twitter, I buy stuff, people recommend things, people post links, I buy stuff all the time and just organically. So I was like, what is an ad? It's just taking a piece of content and then just adding some targeting parameters to it and then expanding the amount of impressions that you give it, right? So why would it not work in theory? So then I just started doing this more and more. And now I work with a handful of clients doing this stuff, just kind of as like a little side project for me. But it's pretty cool. Like, they work pretty well. I mean, there's definitely some nuance. It's definitely a different platform than Meta. With Meta, they want you to just like pop up an ad, pop up your creative and say, go
Trust
18
us.
plus US and just find my people. And what's cool about Meta is like so many data points. They know who your people are. But the downside of that is that some clients that I've talked to have, you know, they might be spending hundreds of thousands of dollars or more a month. What happens is that, you know, there's like these internal buckets within Meta, or I guess the best analogy I have for it. It's like, so within the bucket, when your ads are in the bucket, you're making sales all the time, but like sometimes it's hard to scale out of that bucket into a new bucket of inventory, right? And people get capped out with the amount that they could spend. They just can't push any higher in a profitable way. With X, you have a little bit more room to run because you could choose your targeting parameters. So it's almost a little bit more like Google PPC or direct mail, where like with direct mail, like back in the day, it's like you would rent individual lists. You would take your letter and say, I want to rent this person's list. Okay, how did this perform? Let's do this person's list. And you would roll out your campaign to all these different list universes. You can create those list universes within the targeting parameters of X.
Okay. So, you know, X is going to be more kind of, I would just describe that as like old school digital marketing where you have to do audience building. And in addition to that, like keyword targeting, right? So you like you're building your own audience that you're going to target. So like there's a little bit of skill in that. Like how do you do that? Like is it better to build on keywords? Is it better to build based on, you know, content creators and their profiles? Or is it better to build on like demographics?
So it's a little bit of all three. Demographics definitely are big, and a lot of times I just look like looking at like Google Analytics data, and sometimes with clients, like I had one client who, you know, over 60% of their customers were female. So I said, why don't for this first campaign, why don't we just target, like I think if it's like you have one bolt in the gun, it's like how are we going to hit the target? It's like let's just target females and let's just say, okay, we're going to run this specific campaign because it skews more. And then even within the age parameters, I said let's make the age parameters a little bit higher than normal, just because that's where they're, you know, the most amount of sales were coming from. So I said let's start there, and then what we do is layer on the keywords and the follower lookalikes. They're called you know, profile lookalikes. So the way that that works is essentially like you could choose 10, 20, 30 profiles, and then it'll generate a lookalike audience based off their followers. Now, I have to imagine that, like, so it's, I don't, it might just be mislabeled. I'm not exactly sure. There's a few wonky things in terms of the UX inside the dashboard they're still working out. But I would imagine a large percentage of people, like if you're in one specific industry or one specific, you know, topic cluster of people, you know, there's like these little corners of Twitter. It's like esoteric health Twitter and, you know, architecture Twitter and, you know, sneaker Twitter, and like there's all these different like little like hobby corners, right? So I'd imagine that like you're gonna get a lot of the, even if you do a lookalike and it's not all of their followers, if you have 10 other people who are in that circle, you'll get enough of those people, right? So a lot of times it's finding good follower lookalikes where you can get a, you know, a significant amount of people. You want to definitely have at least a few hundred thousand, if not a million people within your targeting pool, generally speaking. Unless it's like, you know, you're a higher end B2B SaaS company and you know you only have, you know, 5,000 people on earth who might be customers, and then you might want to target just some smaller, like super high-end profiles. You know, that happens sometimes, right? So it's a little bit of just like researching the audience, but if it's a more mass market product, you can go obviously more mass market. I had one of my clients, they are in the they have an anxiety telemedicine business, and they also have an insomnia product as well. And they just ran it super broad like Meta, and they were actually able to make sales that way, because I think for that, it's just there's so many people with anxiety and these kind of issues that, like, you know, you could just let it run, right? But not every business is going to be like that, so it is better to dial it down a little bit more. But they also have this feature that I'm not sure how to. I could see why this might work, and I could see why it might be a waste of time. Like they have this button in the Ads Manager called Optimized Targeting, where you can click it on, and it will use the information that's gathered from the campaign and your targeting parameters, and make it more like a Meta experience where it'll go broad and test out different pockets of people. I've had success with some clients with that, and some clients it's tanked the results. I'm still trying to figure out, like, when I've talked with their team, they're like, oh, you should be using that button. And I'm like, okay, I believe you, right? But I'm a little bit hesitant because I'm like, does it actually work really well? Or is it one of those things where it's like, we have all this inventory, we need to monetize this inventory. So by pushing this button on, you know, like within Google, there's certain features where it's just like a sinkhole for your ad spend, right? It's like you don't want to have certain things on because it's just going to show it to junk inventory. Like, I don't know what the case is, right? I could see why it might be legit. And I've had, like, I have one client who we did some targeting, and like the audience was just too small. We kicked it up to optimize targeting, but it was a geofence campaign. So it just brought it out much bigger. So it accomplished the goal for that client. But I had another client where we did it and the results kind of tanked. So There's a lot of different, like, it's a lot of testing. I mean, that's all advertising, though, right? Like, no matter what platform you're on, it's always going to be the same. It's just a ton of testing.
Yeah, so, I mean, my goal in this podcast is, like, what are the tests that have been done that are like, almost law, you know, at this point, as we're recording this? Like, here are things that you absolutely do not do. Like, here are the things. Like, how much do you spend on an ad before you know if it's effective or not? Like, do you know that answer?
Typically what we do is, like, we like to roll campaigns out that are like $50 or $100 a day, and then at least let it run for about a week or so. And the reason why is they do have a learning phase too, because I've asked their engineers about this, and it doesn't say, like, in Facebook, it'll say,
I want to dig into that a little bit. Okay. So what is a campaign? Is that a group of ads, or is that just one ad?
Yes. Typically, like, for a campaign, it'll be, we'll pick a product and we'll then, you know, have different ad groups and ads around that one product. So if you have, you know, five different products, you want to run five different campaigns, you just have five of those, and then you'd have variations of those ads within each campaign.
Okay. So I have a campaign, and then I have, let's say I have like two different ad groups, one for this style of ad, one's a video ad, one's a text-based ad. And then within that, I have like ABC, three different versions of that. So I have like six total ads, two ad groups, one campaign, right? And then you're saying in this campaign, you want to run it at $50 to $100 a day for about a week?
Yeah, that's generally where I start. Again, like, sometimes people have smaller budgets, sometimes people have bigger budgets, but I like to just start there because it gives enough volume. Again, because the CPMs might be, you know, I've had as low as like 38 cents, and then some clients might be as high as like $5. I mean, sometimes if they're a little bit higher than that, you usually need to change some targeting parameters, but it's much more affordable on a CPM basis, which is nice. Again, obviously most people listening to this are probably looking for ROAS and don't care as much about that, and totally understandable.
But I think it's helpful. So you said if you start seeing CPMs above $5, then it's getting a little wonky.
For the most part, I mean, there might be some exclusions to that rule, but like one of my clients I started working with, you know, he had CPMs that were like, he had CPMs that were like $40 or $50, and he was paying like $18 a click. And I was like, this is completely broken. So we had to like go and retool everything, and we got it down. I think, I got to check what his CPMs were, but they're probably around like $2 or $3. Okay. So then it was more in a comfortable range, and you're starting to get conversions from that. So again, it might vary. I just want to give that disclaimer, but CPM should not be like if you're getting the same CPM as you are on Facebook with Twitter ads, you're probably doing something wrong. You need to change the targeting parameters, possibly expand a little bit more. Cause you might also be running into, you know, just too much frequency if you have too small of a targeting pool.
Okay. So we kind of have it built out. Is the audience targeting done at a campaign level or at an ad level, or where is that done?
Ad group level.
Okay. Ad group level. Okay. So you could have effectively, like, let's say we have two ads duplicated, but just two different audiences. So two different ad groups. Is that typically how you're doing it, or how are you setting it all the way up from a campaign perspective?
I'll typically, like, so you can't set it from the campaign level, but if you want, you could run one ad group with the variations in there. And there might be like different reasons for doing it that way, depending on the setup that you're running. But I've typically just kept it simple that way and say, okay, I want to try to find the targeting pool that works first. And then once we know there's like fish in the pond, then we can start putting different pieces of bait on the hook, right? So I'll usually try to go a little bit broad. I'll test the number of different angles, and then I'll start, you know, killing the losers and doubling down on the winners. So if we're spending $100 a day and there's 10 ads, and then I find like four of the ads are just getting zero traction, super high, you know, cost per click, no conversions, whatever, I'll just kill those, and it'll just funnel more of the money automatically to the ones that are winning. And then we try to just let that run as long as possible before launching new creative.
Okay. How many ad groups are you doing in a campaign, and how many ads per ad group?
It does vary depending on how much creative the clients have. One thing that we had to do with one client that was a little bit annoying was you can't sometimes when it's kicking the data back over from the pixel back into the Twitter ads manager, you can't always get super granular at the ad level in terms of seeing the conversions. And when I asked the X team about this, they said, if you look from the ad group level, you'll be able to have the data, but there's some like privacy thing at the ad level. It doesn't really make sense to me, but it's some like weird rule. So what we did for that client was we just broke one ad per ad group, and we had like 10 different ad groups running with one ad just so we can get a little bit more granular targeting on this one. So it does vary. Like, I don't have a hard and fast answer. I mean, maybe eventually I will arrive at a hard and fast answer, But for now, it just kind of depends on, like, you know, if someone comes to me and they have six pieces of creative and that's it, right? And so we just want to roll out with that. We'll just keep them all under one. If they have a ton more, then sometimes we'll break it out into different pieces. But
okay, so yeah. It's kind of more creative basis that you'll go into. But because I always wonder, like, you know, if I've got 10 different ad groups in one campaign, you know, is that giving Twitter too much? Or if I just have one, you know, is that also like messing with things? So like if there is or isn't a sweet spot, it's kind of good to know. Let's dig into like ad creative and strategies for that. Have you seen any type of, like, Twitter's nice because you can now do long form posts in it. So you can do that long storytelling copy based stuff. You can do, you know, like video ads. You can do, you know, what kind of strategy should people start with from an ad creative strategy?
So we've made everything work. You know, we've made long form ads work. We've made videos work. We've made static work. I think the easiest thing for most people to get started is just take some winning static from Meta, because most people listening to this are probably already advertising there, and roll that out. So like take your best winners and say, okay, we're just going to roll it out with, you know, some small copy there, have a link in the body text as well as, you know, a link on the actual ad itself. But static ads tend to get significantly more reach in terms of impressions. Again, that might not always be the most important thing, obviously, but I just noticed that from like a CPM perspective and just overall impressions perspective, the statics definitely get a further and wider reach. They've stated this publicly a number of times, like they're trying to push more towards to be like video first, just because I think personally, this is my assumption, is that, you know, with the success of TikTok and Reels and everything else, like video is powerful. But while I understand while they're doing that, I like Twitter because it's more text-based. I think a lot of people do too. So I think that's why the statics might just get a little bit more reach. Again, this is just anecdotal observations, but and theories. But I think if you just start with static, it's solid. But we made video work too as well. I mean, if it's a good captivating video that you know demonstrates the product, dimensionalizes it, it's attention grabbing, it could work really, really well. The cool thing about it too is that like with like I've seen ads get a lot of just like extra engagement from just being like showing up natively in the feed. Like I feel like the feeds work a little bit different. Like if someone shares something, like shares an ad on Facebook, I feel like it doesn't have as much power as like if someone shares an ad on X. Like I've had people retweet my ads and things, and that drives a lot of new engagement and clicks and profile views and followers and those kind of things. I could be wrong. I feel like it doesn't happen as much on Meta in their ecosystem, but with Twitter, it's just more like open air, you know? So you might have an opportunity if it's like a really crazy ad or really like unique concept and it almost becomes like a memeable thing that gets a lot of like viral traction. Sometimes that happens.
Well, I got a couple more questions for you. Like I have a personal account and I have a business account. Should my ads be under Beard Brand or under, you know, me as the founder of Beard Brand?
You can make them both work. You know, it depends. Like if there's sometimes people run it from the business account. If they're using, there's like an upgraded yellow check. I believe it's a yellow or gold check, whatever it is, where there's some extra incentives, you know, ad spend credits, things like that, if you have that. So sometimes people like running it from the business account because of that. It also depends, like if you're very congruent with what you talk about as the founder, if you're kind of like a thought leader in the space, it works well. But if you're just like going to like I do a lot of like just shit posting on Twitter, right? So like I'll run it like for me, like services, like people are kind of like buying me or buying, you know, what I'm talking about. But like if it's like a consumer product and you're the founder, but you don't really talk about that stuff, it might make sense more to run it from the business account. But you can make it work both ways. I mean, it's not the most important factor, but a lot of times people will just click over and be like, oh, who is this person or what is this brand, right? And then, you know, if it's optimized with the URL and the, you know, header image and they see it, they get it, they click through, like that's another path that leads towards the sale.
Yeah. And then let's talk about attribution. How good is, I've heard the Twitter pixel is not very good. How do you know when things are working or not working? Do you lean on the CPM as, or no. the cost per click or like, where are you really trusting the data?
The attribution isn't exceptional. It's not bad. I think they'll continue to improve it. I mean, what I think works best is if you can kind of like reduce the amount of variables, because like you'll see conversions reported in Ads Manager, and sometimes that'll maybe be a little bit different than what you see in like Google Analytics or Triple Whale or whatever. The problem is, it's like, it's still, I know it sounds weird to say this, but it's still such a like new platform, even though it's been around for so long. Like, people really haven't historically done a lot unless you're like Netflix or DraftKings or these big, you know, or MasterCard or Visa, who, you know, these big, huge brands, right? That a lot of the cottage industry, you know, softwares haven't built too many integrations for it, but that's starting to change. I mean, like Shopify just announced they're doing a new integration with X. They did that in February. I think they announced that. So like, I think we're going to start to see more of those integrations and cleaner attribution data being passed through. But what I tell people a lot of times, I say, just take whatever page, if it's a squeeze page, if it's a product page or whatever it is, or it's a you know, single product focused landing page, whatever, and just clone it. And just know, like, the only traffic that's going to that page is from Twitter. So that way you can at least measure that way. So it's a little bit cleaner. I think, you know, attribution is always the toughest thing, especially nowadays too, because it's like, maybe they see the Twitter ad and they click through your profile and they Google you to look for reviews, and then they land on your site organically and they buy, or, you know, like, it's hard to map the journey. We always try to get as close as possible, but I think if you can kind of separate it, you know, using UTM, separate landing pages, things like that, you can get closer to, you know, the truth of what it is.
Where can you go for like ad inspiration? Because Facebook's got a nice library where you can look at everything, but does X have something like that?
They do outside of the US, which is kind of weird. One of my coaching students is in England, and she sent me over a link, but I was having trouble viewing it because I'm not in the EU. If you go to like Big Spy, that's one software. I think it's called bigspy.com, I believe is the URL. I mean, they have ad libraries for just about every single platform, but they have a very extensive Twitter one. You can filter by industry. You can filter by impressions, engagement, style, static versus video versus whatever. There's probably a few other softwares out there. I know Big Spy is one that I've used before, where you can, you know, you could see like what are the highest performing ads of the day. Like, you can spend a lot of time going down that rabbit hole. Like, there's thousands and thousands of examples, but that's the one that I found that I think is best. There might be others, but that's just the one that I know.
And then when you're looking at ads, like, what is a, from my perspective, what is a successful ad? Like, is it 1 million impressions? Is it 500,000? Is it, you know, like, at what point? And I'm like, okay, this is an ad worth being inspired by.
It's a good question. I mean, I think in general, there might be some exclusions to this rule, right? But I think in general, like, the more impressions an ad has, there's a reason that it's being left on. You know, we don't always know the reasons, obviously, right? Like, sometimes if it's a huge corporation, they might just say, hey, here's our budget, we're just going to spend it, we don't care about the ROAS and things. So we don't always get to see, obviously, the inside of these campaigns, right, looking from the outside. But I think as a general rule, like, if it has a high engagement rate, you know, I look at like impressions and engagement rate too, because if someone's engaging with, you know, it's, you could look at the click-throughs, right? Like, that's obviously one metric, like, in your own platform. But if you can see, I believe Big Spy lets you look at like engagement rate. I need to just double check that. But if you can't view that, then just overall impressions, because again, like, if someone's, even if you're spending $1, $2, you know, for a CPM, if something has 15 million impressions, like, that's still a significant amount of money that someone's spending to keep that ad running. And it's like, you got to ask yourself why.
Yeah. The final thing, you talked about engagement. I've noticed that some of the comments are incredibly toxic on X for an ad. Do you leave those on, or you turn them off, or like, how do you manage all that?
There's some new settings that they've rolled out, I believe this year, end of last year, in terms of like, I think it's called brand safety, or something along those lines, where you can kind of, there's two things. You could choose the type of content that it shows up next to. What I found this even on Meta though too, like, I've had people say horrible things to me there. Like, oftentimes I'll just like delete the comments or block those people. You know, if there's really like a lot of bad
on X, right? You can't delete comments on your ad.
Maybe not. Yeah. So, I mean, I've had some of that, but I've also had some of those, and then I've had some glowing comments, people tagging their friends. And like, so I feel like that's the experience. There's always going to be dipshits, you know, like, no matter what you put out on X, like, it's a weird platform, because you have like the smartest people in the world. You have, you know, VCs, investors, successful entrepreneurs and founders and, you know, scientists and physicists and like all these like genius level people. But you have on the other end of the spectrum, like the absolute like knuckle draggers, like the worst people imaginable. And they're all hanging out in one place. So it's hard. Like, yeah, that happens sometimes. I mean, I would look to see, like, is that, you know, if people saying like really offensive things, you might just turn it off and clone it, obviously. But if it's just people being idiot, like every time I run an ad, people are like, bald, you're a bald idiot. I'm like, okay, cool. You know, like whatever. Like, I don't think that's pulling down the performance of things. I had one person, they're like, you have a drop ceiling. I was like, cool, man. Like, what does that, matter? You know what I mean? Like, nice comment. I don't know, you know? So like, it's always going to happen, but I've had that on Facebook too, you know, and Instagram and things like that. So I know that they're very concerned about it, and they've been rolling out a lot of controls. Maybe that's one of those features that they'll add in terms of like deleting those type of comments on ads. You just do the best that you can, I think, for now.
Yeah. Where can people follow you on X?
My handle is at Chris Orzy, ChrisOrzy. And tweet a lot, spend a lot of time on there. Like to chop it up. People have a good time.
Do some good shit posting. Where else can people follow you, find you, support you?
Yeah. My website is orzy.co. That's ORZY.co. I have an email list where I write every day and just, you know, publish things I'm learning and tell stories about stuff I've been doing with my clients. And yeah.
All right, man. Well, I appreciate it. Go ahead.
I have a book too. Can I mention the book?
Yeah,
It's called The Moat. It's on Amazon. It's about my system for growing brands. It's got a lot of examples and, you know, frameworks and things that you could use. Everything from like acquisition to email marketing, SMS, direct mail, like all that good stuff.
Sweet, man. Check it out. The Moat on Amazon. Beautiful cover. I love that.
Thank you.
Illustration. That looks dope. As always, this has been another e-commerce conversations. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. Hopefully you get some X ads going. That'd be exciting. Not triple X, just single X. As always, thanks. Cheers. Keep on growing.
Thanks so much.